From a distinguished scholar and minister, here's an unexpected comment about sermons preached on Easter. Every time I hear the traditional Easter message, as it is presented in the average pulpit, I have exactly the same feeling as if I had just eaten a 5-pound box of sweet chocolates all at one sitting. Dr. Paul Scherer had heard a great many Easter sermons in the course of his life. He taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. He taught at Princeton. He had a national radio program back in the days when intelligent preaching was acceptable. He wrote provocative books, but he still said, "I am nauseated by too much sweetness in the conventional Easter sermon." For one who has to speak this morning, his comment is a caution light. I wouldn't want to feed you a 5-pound box of predictably sweet chocolate in the next 20 minutes. In fact, when I consider that some of you have not had a meal in this church for months and may not return soon, I tend to think meat and potatoes rather than sweets should make up the menu. But I compromise and try to offer both in what I hope is a healthy mix. So first, I have to say this. For 2,000 years, the church has debated whether the resurrection of Christ was physical or spiritual, whether a corpse came to life again, or whether it was a spirit and a presence that filled the early church with so much hope. Like any other student of the New Testament, I have wrestled with the text and what it means, but more often than not, the wrestling has been done in private, in the study, which is probably where it ought to be done. Certainly not on Easter Sunday morning, when the birth of spring and the celebration of new hope springing out of what seemed to be hopeless call for us to be happy, uncritically happy, with the joyous feeling that something is beginning. I woke up excited about the meaning of this day and the prospect of seeing you. If I can't be sure of the exact nature of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I am quite sure that life is filled with resurrections. All of us, if we are old enough, have passed through something so bad that it felt like death. Hope, horizontal, no future in sight, and then, to our great surprise, have been resurrected after days or months or even years into some new kind of life. One of the reasons all kinds of people go on celebrating Easter, from the most devout fundamentalist to the most studious liberal, is that renewal of life and hope happened to us often enough to make the word resurrection believable. It certainly should be easy for all of us in this church to believe in a resurrection, because we had one. So remarkable that we never will forget what it was like. 4 years ago, this very morning, on the third Sunday in April, a group of us who had seen the death of a relationship, feeling betrayed and disappointed, saw that relationship come back to life in a basement room, in a room that could, for all we knew, have turned out to be nothing more than our grave. It turned out to be our resurrection. We sang, "Morning has broken," because it had. The sunlight that day was all around us and in us. We had no idea what the new day would bring, but we were filled with new life, and we were eager to find out. Life, we had learned once more, is filled with resurrections. We'd never make it without them. One example from an experience in counseling. Some years ago, I spent several sessions with a high-ranking executive from a major industry in Wichita who had been fired after more than 25 years and was decimated. He looked strong. His face and bearing were those of a man used to making important decisions and expecting people to carry them out. But his appearance was deceiving. It became apparent as we talked that he was in the grave of absolute despair. Repeatedly, as we talked, he broke down and cried. He could not imagine himself of any use anymore. He could not understand why, after all the years of loyal service, he had been abruptly dismissed. He talked of suicide. What do you tell a man going through that kind of death? Somehow you want to say there will be a resurrection, but you can't make it sound too easy or glib, especially if, as in this case, the man is highly intelligent and may walk out on you if you are patronizing, if you try to feed him a 5-pound box of chocolates. I realized after a while that because he didn't know me well, he thought my life always ran along on an even tenor, that I would think him weak for feeling what he felt. So I told him about my own times of failure and despair, and how when so much seemed lost, there had been a resurrection to something better than I could have thought possible. He seemed to take a little comfort from knowing that we had spent time in kindred graves. And by, with the help of his wife and his children, he slowly pulled himself together enough to offer his skills on other markets. There were a few disappointments, but then came the Easter morning of his life when a new job was offered in a beautiful city and all his confidence came back. I have heard from him since. He seems happier than he ever was, even in the days before he thought his life had ended. He has learned, he tells me, to spend better time with his wife and his children and himself, and not to put all his eggs into the basket of corporate ambition. He is quite literally a man resurrected into a life filled with new and shining hopes. That's the kind of true story that belongs to Easter, that word which is synonymous with fresh starts. I'd like to consider for just a moment a couple of the ways in which a new beginning can make so much difference. I can't think of anything that needs fresh starts more now and then than love does. We take one another for granted. We fall into humdrum ruts. We need to be reawakened. I observed a man and his wife in a popular restaurant the other day. She read a book. He read some business papers for 45 minutes. Totally oblivious to each other from the first glass of water to the final toothpick. At home, I realized that might only mean that they simply felt secure in one another's love. But in the restaurant, it looked more like a relationship out of which all shared excitement had vanished. I kept hoping one of them would look up to smile and ask, "Is it a good book?" Or the other would laugh and share something. It never happened. And one certainly had the feeling that they were both escaping, hiding in their paper and book because life and love had gone stale. They looked stale, as if they could use an Easter in their lives. Sadly, the fresh start all too often grows out of some tragedy. My sister called right after Christmas some years ago to tell us that she had a deadly form of cancer. And after it was clear that there was not much hope, her husband became desperate to make a fresh start, to rejuvenate their love, to do all the things he had been putting off. So he did them in the next few months, although by that time some of them had a rather forced and desperate look. My sister, having grown up in a family where a vacation to Hawaii was an unimaginable luxury, had always thought that would be the ultimate trip. So he bought the tickets and they rushed off to Hawaii. He loved her dearly, but like most of us, they had come to take each other for granted, to go for long periods of time without hearing from the other a word of appreciation. And a word of appreciation can prompt the fresh start we need. I remember when my daughter was 4 or 5, how she came into my office at home one day to show me a new dress. It was obvious she expected me to rave about it, which I did. And when I was through, she looked at me glowingly and said, "Daddy, is there anything I can do for you?" We like a compliment. It brings us back to life. Sometimes there is a fresh beginning when we finally can share our inner world with the people we love. I remember the husband and wife who had forgotten how to talk except to quarrel, and how one day they learned at the hospital that their 6-year-old son had leukemia. He looked over at her on the way home and said, "Doesn't all our quarreling seems silly compared to this?" And there was a new beginning that day for those two people. First, a kind of death, and then a resurrection. Sometimes in a relationship with other people, sometimes in the loneliness of your own mind and heart, when you find yourself in some kind of intellectual and emotional grave, and you can't imagine how to get out of it. I had that happen once. When the intricate system my church had designed for me clashed with the realities of life. My church had all the answers and made fun of those who were troubled by questions. And I gladly bought that dogmatic way of life as a child. Young people love to be sure about things. And I rode a crest of certainty for years. Then came the war, and I woke up in London one morning after a V2 had hit a children's hospital and killed 500 kids. And I saw the living skeletons from the Nazi death camps, and my neat system caved in, because it was not strong enough for that reality. I couldn't fight the doubts any longer, so my life, the life I had lived up to that time, died and was buried along with some tears and some terror. I began to read everything I could find that dealt with the important issues of life. And I thought about what I was reading. And I slowly came to realize there were two things that I believed in beyond all doubt. Two may seem a pitiably small number to you. But when you've gotten there on your own, it seems like a multitude. So one thing I became positive I could believe in, could build a new life on, was love. I mean love in its broadest sense. In the New Testament sense expressed by the word agape, the kind in which you care about people who are not at all lovable in themselves. You care about them because you really have no choice, because God has required it. I never will know completely all that means, and putting it into practice is very hard for me, but I believe there is no deeper wisdom than the greatest of all the Christian promises. If you love, you live. And the other thing I came to believe in is that the worst thing in life is to be a phony, to pretend you are above failure, to pretend you are much more certain about everything than you really are, to pretend you are so much better than other people that you make some of them feel ashamed. Christ, I realized, had already made that point clear on the day when some people tried to pay him too much honor and he rejected it. Why do you call me good? Only one is good. If he could say that, then I could be myself. Those two convictions, the primacy of love, the relief of honesty, For a while, they were all I had. After the death of my adolescent faith. Since then, some other convictions have come, but the good news is they're mine. They're not my father's, not my church's, but mine. To hold and use because they were built out of a long search for what I could embrace as truth. So I believe in the words of Easter, in things starting over, in the resurrection of lost integrity, in the resurrection of shattered confidence, in the resurrection of trust again after betrayal. I believe that out of pain, out of death, new life is forever forming. The word that Easter says clearest of all to me is, don't give up. New life, in the most unexpected kind of way, is taking shape. Now, most of you, I know, have come on this beautiful day full of optimism and hope and confidence, your life as bright as the April sun. Most of you. But not far from where you sit, betraying no sign of it, someone else has come who is desperately tired of doing battle with an illness, worn out with daily weakness, crushed with the burden of watching over someone else, fearful for the future of a child, troubled about a love or a friendship, tangled in a web of deceit that threatens to ruin everything. To all of you who carry one or more of those burdens and have come this day in search of hope, this is the promise. Life is filled with resurrections. In the name of this Easter morning, claim yours.